Today on Wings, part two of Mindy Rand's interview about witches with feminist archivist and historian Max Dashew. Part one looked at the long history of witch accusations and trials that made women the scapegoats for European discontent. Part two considers surviving evidence of traditional practices and how ancient knowledge has sometimes been distorted and sometimes carried forward in images and practices today. Max Dashew.
It's important to track what kind of testimony we can get out of the folk cultures, because even just following that linguistic train, we can see a body of evidence that, in fact, these women were respected and seen as leaders. Linguistically, the titles for these women were not devil worshiper or someone who harms other people through magic, but they mean knower, seer, healer, herbalist, elder, wise woman. So this is the paradox of the witches, that even just the concept of what witch became, how witch got defined as this negative thing, was because they were women of power who had social recognition for it.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Max Dashew has spent more than 50 years collecting evidences of women's activities from prehistory and history, and organizing them in what she calls the Suppressed Histories Archives. Within the archives is a 16-volume series titled The Secret History of the Witches. Volume 10 of that series covers the relationships of witches with variously named goddesses. Mindy Rann asked for more information about that.
I want to talk a little bit about what you cover in looking at the witch's goddess and looking at the positive aspects. Mm-hmm. So first of all, place us in a time frame.
Okay, well, we can't really put a starting point on this because it's just buried in the mists of time. But what we find is that witches were associated with goddess veneration, which is already blasphemous and heretical from the point of view of the clergy. So there's a problem to begin with there. But from the folk culture standpoint, these were beloved deities. Their great folk holidays were celebrated around them. We're now coming up to the winter solstice. And this was a major celebration all across Europe that was associated with the old goddess, whether she was called Frau Holle in Germany or Bertha in some parts of, or Bertha in Austria, or the Lithuanian goddess Laima, and you have Andra Mari among the Basques. These old goddesses are goddesses of the winter nights. They're spinners. Spinning and weaving are consecrated to them. So there's all kinds of ceremonies around those things. And then the feasts of that season. And so these are outright goddesses, and each ethnic group in Europe had a name for them. They were usually associated with Friday as their sacred day and with spinning and weaving. We also see the fairy faith, which has kind of been diminished to local divinities. But the fairy women are really goddesses in their own right, but they're kind of more of a collective goddess that inhabit the waters and the forests and the mountains. And people are doing ceremony with them. And this goes back a very long way. We can track it in the churchly records. And then there's this idea that witches go by night with the goddess. And this mythology comes into view around the year 900 in priestly writings. You have a couple bishops who talk about women who fly with the goddess Diana on the backs of beasts in innumerable numbers and fly across the grass tracts of land. So they're flying to a ceremony for this goddess. And this mythology gets developed, and we see it mainly through what elite men, literate men, have written down. But this later morphs into a narrative about witches flying to ceremonies, which now have been changed by the men into devil worship, and even to witches having sex with the devil. So all these pornographic fantasies get interjected into the old folk tradition. But this is all very much bound up with various fairy traditions and ceremonies women would do seasonally to lay out offerings for the fairy women, the good women, as they were called in French, the beneficent women in German, but also on occasions of births. So they had birth fairy observances that lasted in some places, like in Normandy. They were still doing this in the 19th century. So there are pockets where this never got totally stamped out, in spite of all the fire and iron that was brought to bear by church and state to get rid of it. People loved these ceremonies and they hung on to them. And if you talk about like St. Nicholas and, you know, Santa Claus and that whole story, there are earlier versions of this with a goddess who was called Befana in Italy, which was taken from the Christian name Epiphania, the Feast of the Epiphany, or Tante Ari in parts of Eastern France. There are various local names for these goddesses who are associated with that winter night celebration. So in Germany, you would have Bertha would make an appearance in the form of a young woman who had a headdress of candles. And she would be bringing in baskets of apples and other goodies to the family. She would make a ritual appearance, you know, and so there were these ceremonies that preceded Santa Claus. And it's interesting to see the you know, a lot of the Christian observances with the Christmas tree all come out of much older pagan roots.
I was also thinking about the connection of coming back into light and bringing mm-hmm. light.
Yeah, definitely, because it's the dark of the year. So it's a feast of lights. The winter yes. nights are a time for that. We have an aspect of ourselves that's rational. We have vast other areas that are just much more, you can't define. You know, it's like that right brain part of our being. You know, we yes. have faculties and capacities that go far beyond what the rationalistic mind can do. which are great things in its own right. It has to do also with the cycle of the seasons, being embedded in the time-space matrix in a way that you're commemorating those passages and you're living them fully in the body with music and feasting and lights and dance and gift-giving.
What sort of resistance and rebellion was there?
That's very hard to track. You know, it's like our records are left to us from the elite men. So what goes on in the villages? I mean, occasionally you'll find there's one dramatic example from northwestern Italy, and the Inquisition had already been ravaging for 100 years with witch hunts in the Western Alps. And in the foothills around Torino and Piemonte, there was a revolt. There was a peasant revolt in 1518 against the inquisitorial witch hunts. But in general, I'd say that the unity of the common people was broken long before that in a lot of Western Europe, you know, and I see 1390 or somewhere thereabouts as the breaking point where what had been the theologians' demonologies and accusations and the, you know, supported by, you know, the Christian elite, the aristocratic upper elite supported the church and actually filled those ranks in very many cases. But the common people had a resistance. This is coming out of feudalism. And they were really skeptical of things that were being imposed by the church. They had kind of a strategy of resisting that, but not openly defying it, you know, just kind of going along and just holding on, being steadfast in their culture. The common people loved their ancestral traditions. And so they kept them. And they were useful to them in whatever illnesses or injuries or, you know, the dangers of birth or all the things that they faced or, you know, dealing with drought or whatever it may be. That was their survival bag that they could reach into because they didn't even have access to medical care from the doctors. Couldn't afford it. The doctors were an educated elite. And in many ways, you know, it wasn't always the case that this was a tragic loss for them because those doctors were giving out heavy metals as medicine, you know, mercury and all these things, you know, that really are bad for you. But that began to break up as there was through the torture trials and because of the theologians, the inquisitors' demonologies, the devil worship narrative and the accusations that witches were in the service of the devil and were harming crops and all of these things really began to take on force. And this divided people in a way. I mean, I have no illusions. Europe was a patriarchal society before this, right? A set of patriarchal societies. But there were still some elements, you know, female spheres of power is the way I conceptualize that, that the healer, the diviner, the old wise woman, the female elder, that had still had their place, had a place to stand. And the accusations that spread and gained force with these torture trials and the diabolism, this devil worship meme and witches killing babies and all these kinds of things broke that, the remnants of that cultural unity. And of course, the other peasant revolts in slightly later periods also all failed. And so there was a move towards scapegoating, and both witches and Jews took that brunt of that rage, that popular rage.
During the witch sort of trial frenzy that was going on that you referred to, the witch frenzy, was there any resistance? Or was it so far underground?
That's what I'm trying to say, is that it's not visible to us historically. You have a few examples. The only ones that really come to mind is you have Cornelius Agrippa, who was a humanist, who did speak out. There was a doctor named Johannes Weyer who spoke out, and this was not well received. And you have to understand, too, that Weyer's position was deeply misogynist. He thought these were just senile old women who fantasized these things. He didn't even see the element of coercion in the torture chamber. And so, you know, even the progressives sometimes had their heads screwed on wrong. Among the common people, it's very difficult to track. I mean, I don't know of any cases where they were storming the inquisitorial prisons and liberating the prisoners. Yeah, everything that the inquisitors did was backed up by the force of the state. And this is a pattern that originates much earlier, because when you have Charlemagne invading Saxony and destroying the old shrines and deporting the Saxons, you know, resistance was death after they occupied that region of what's now northwestern Germany. Eventually, you know, they Christianized the area at speed, because it was death otherwise. You know, a lot of people were marched off into slavery in France in, you know, the 9th century, and these draconian laws. So this was a process that unfolded over time. People knew very well what the cost was of rebellion. And as I say, the unity was broken, because their revolts, all the revolts that were not against the witch hunts, but were against aristocratic domination, you know, and the enclosure of the commons, those things, in all cases, the peasantry lost. And so what happened with that rage is it got diverted into horizontal, you know, or against foreign others, like the Jews and the Roma people.
You mentioned that even the French Revolution was misogynistic.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of women were involved in that. I mean, there was very strong exclusion of women. You did have women's Republican clubs and all of those things, but there's quite a bit of evidence of severe misogyny on the part of the men. Olympe de Gouges was a very progressive woman, feminist, all these. She was like more of a liberal or a moderate. But under Robespierre, a lot of people who had been supporters of the revolution got sent to the guillotine.
On Wings, you're listening to feminist archivist and historian Max Dashue being interviewed on the subject of witches by contributing producer Mindy Ran. Mindy now turns the discussion to whether witches have been rehabilitated in the modern Western imagination.
There's tons of popular culture in the last 20 years, particularly around witches and witchcraft. Not all of it putting witches in the ugly old devil worship camp. Do you see this as a shift in attitudes?
It's very complex. I think it retains a lot of the memes, like the Addams Family, for example. Wednesday is a character that's, you know, really lovable in many ways, just counterintuitively. But, you know, the whole construction of the Addams Family as possessed of extreme wealth, and framing that if you're witches, then you love to cut the heads off of roses and put the thorny stems into, you know, it's almost like the world upside down. Everything they do is the opposite of what society does. That really has nothing to do with the folk ethnic religions of Europe before the witch hunts. There have been all these very imaginative spiralings of new stories that still retain a lot of, like, you know, the demonization of witches. In the Addams Family, it's kind of on their side. So it's kind of like a counter narrative in many ways, but it's still somehow the idea of witches as being imbued with a negative, loving death. With J.K. Rowling, it's complicated for me, because I enjoyed the books, and yet I couldn't help but notice, I mean, this was really her choice. The fact that she chose a male hero, and you've got two males and one female, and they're the core. And women are very much background characters. All the important characters, except for Hermione, are male. You know, you've got some colorful, you've got the Maggie Smith character, and you've got, well, I mean, I'm talking about the movies now, but, yeah. You know, just whoever that corresponds with. Dumbledore is a prominent figure. So is Severus Snape. There's a demonic woman, Bellatrice, a supporter of Voldemort. But women are very much in the back row. The other thing about it, as much as it's enjoyable, the idea of somewhere up in Northern England is this castle where there's this witch college going on, is that the kind of witchcraft that is being presented is using spells in Latin. And this is what happened more generally in Europe, the idea that this is all something, you know, the Latinate learning of elite men and the kinds of magic that Dr. John Dee was doing or others who were persecuted also, but I think he escaped with his life, you know, is something of an entirely different order of magnitude to the old woman who goes to the spring and gathers south flowing water to bathe the sick baby with, you know, or who is smudging the child with mugwort smoke. That's very much earth-based land traditions that were handed down generationally. And this comes through a little bit in Rowling's work, except that, strangely enough, they're all celebrating Christmas, you know, at Hogwarts. It's like, okay, what does this have to do with witches? You know, they're kind of like domesticated witches in a certain way. I have mixed feelings about it.
And do you see it as cultural appropriation in a way?
No, because, you know, it's much her cultural heritage as anyone, you know. It's more just that there's kind of like such a massive misdirection away from the authentic traditions. And modern people have found all kinds of ways to play with that. And playing with it sometimes in very disrespectful ways. Like there's a brand of some kind of wine that has as its label a witch burning at the stake. And this is supposed to be edgy and, you know, ironic commentary or something like that. But it's just more rare to see an acknowledgement of the relationality with the land, with animacy, you know, the idea of sacred springs and wells. And a lot of that got appropriated by the church. So, you know, we go through multiple phases. It's very difficult to just go black and white with this, because the well that once was called our, you know, they might call it Our Lady's Well or some saint name instead of whatever it was called before. So that, to me, that's the authentic core tradition. And then there's all these overlayers, and there's persecution, and there's reaction against persecution. And I think feminists very much turned around and said, no, we see in the witches our resistant ancestors who refuse to knuckle under, who are not willing to be under the thumb of men, who had a women's wisdom tradition out of their cultural heritage that they preserved, and that they resisted church-state domination by holding to it. You know, so there's something true about that. But I see it very much missing in a lot of the mass media iterations. I mean, the Witches of Eastwick and all the movies have been made. They're not written by women. They're not, you know, the screenwriters aren't women. The whole way that it's done, I mean, there's this one male devil character who they are basically enthralled to. And so it's still male domination narrative.
Do you think these will have any lasting cultural impact? My feeling from listening to you is that you think they're far too shallow and it's just like a light rinse.
Well, they're shallow, but I think it's worse than a light rinse. I think that they're really missing fundamentally the point, and they are reiterating something about the same domination-based narratives that we've been having since the 1500s, if not sooner in some countries. They're still buying in some way to the framing of the witch from a male dominance perspective. And sometimes they're doing it in ways that they feel are resistant, like the internet is awash with images that are attempting to reclaim the witch. But she's young and sexy and pouting and sticking her breasts out. There's one meme that keeps circulating on Facebook. It has a painting of women who are burning at the stake, and their long hair is blowing in the wind. And one of them is wearing a very low-cut ball gown, which, after you've been in the witch's dungeon for 4 months or 7 months and starved and beaten and raped, you are not going to look like that. And they didn't ever, to begin with, have clothing like that, most of the women, witch trials. So there's a romanticization of it. And they do empathize with the witch, but they have a fundamentally false narrative about what that looked like. You know, and that these are women who were oppressed, right? And there's another meme that circulates that talks about how, well, the witches had pointed hats, and this somehow had something to do with beer brewing. And that beer brewing was this tremendously profitable enterprise that the witches were getting rich off of, and that's why they were persecuted, because the men wanted the wealth that these women had. And it's like, wow. You know, ale brewing was certainly one way, one of the very few ways that women could earn some money. You know, we have spinning, which was paid a pittance that you could not even survive on. Brewing was a little better, but it required you have a place to live. You know, you had a house of your own in some way. And they didn't make a whole lot of money off it. It was something they could eat off of, right? But there's all this mythology, and it's, I see women eating this up. It's like, wow, here's a female empowerment narrative. But it's false. And brewing didn't really have anything to do with witches. These constructions of alternative narratives, and even more, the visual representations that are very much pornified. If you Google witch in any language, you know, Russian and Japanese, just as much as English or Spanish, and you will find a pornified vision of what they take to be a powerful woman.
I want to look at a positive or positive legacies of witches.
Okay, so there's a whole reclamation going on. It has been for the last half a century, even more, to reclaim the positive legacies of the witches, of the ethnic cultures. You know, we could call those the ancestral European heritages, or any other heritages where, you know, this has been, where women's power has been contested in these ways, or absolutely smashed in these ways. And so, you know, there's been a wave of cultural movements towards reclaiming the female divine. You've got, you know, the goddess spirituality movement. You have the witches, you know, various witch organizations or ceremonies. Most famous is Starhawk with the spiral dance, and saying, wait a minute, the witches were not evil. They were earth spirituality people. You know, they were doing cures. They were doing community celebrations. And, you know, these old ethnic holidays were something relating to, you know, the solstices, the equinoxes, various things on a calendar, on an ancient calendar, that related to celebrating earth and life and the cycles of time. So that's all been going on. And I would say that even a larger sphere than just the European reclamations, in Mexico, we can see women who are calling themselves brujas. And there are movements in Oakland, California, you know, of brujas and women by other names who are saying, wait a minute, we know that these women were done injustice and there were a lot of good things about them. They defied the patriarchal authority. They stood up for women. They stood up for the life principle. And so, yes, we are like them and we reclaim them. So that's been happening. And in a lot of ethnic contexts, you've got Jew witches. In the Jewish tradition, you know, that would, Starhawk, I guess, would be part of that, but there's many other forms. And there was a program called Kohenet, which was Jewish women who were reclaiming the priestess tradition, going back really far in time. And this is happening. All of these different cultural reclamations and decolonizations are going on, you know, in parallel in a lot of different ethnic contexts, because I think there's a recognition that this accretion of domination-based culture is severely damaging. And, you know, really, at this point, it's endangering the biosphere and humanity itself. This is really momentous because it's happening in a global way. We're living in a globalized culture. And for women to be able to stand up and say the divine exists in female forms, and we don't have to only bow down to a father god. We don't have to bow down to anything, come to that, right? But that we affirm life principle, this is amazing. And there are all these beauteous cultural fluorescences happening of women drummers circles, you know, in the African tradition, other traditions, and, you know, in First Nations, women doing powwow drumming. And, you know, there's just many, many ways that these reclamations are happening. So these are affirmations of life. And we're still living with the legacies of the past, but really the imperative is to change the negative legacies and to resurrect and get to know what are the positive legacies.
Do you have hope for the future?
Well, I hope the biosphere survives all of this. You know, it's I think that cultural transformation is really key because you cannot only organize politically, although that's important to do, but there has to be something that we revive ourselves, we revive our